What's going on? This is the After the Snow podcast, brought to you by Breakbeat Media. You know, we're that new authentically hip-hop podcast network. And I'm your co-host, Dave Mays. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Breakbeat. Happy to join you guys every week on this After the Snow podcast, along with my illustrious co-host, Mr. Freeway, Rick Ross.
What up, Dave?
What's up? What's up, Rick?
Man, let's get it. Let's get it.
Yeah. Feeling
another
good?
Day in the office. Yeah. Things been going all right. You know, we going to keep fighting, Dave.
Definitely. Tell everyone where you're at, what part of the country, and what you're doing out there.
I'm in Cincinnati, Ohio, one of my old stomping grounds back in the days, you know. At Busy One radio station, you know, getting ready, man. Can't wait to get started on this new episode. Well, not a new episode. It's an old episode, but it's the first time that we ever ventured into this episode. So it should be interesting.
Dope. Yeah, shout out Cincinnati. It's a long history of hip hop in that town, going back to the 80s. I remember when I was first doing The Source and talking to a lot of radio and DJs around the country. Icy D, he was the guy out there really holding hip hop down for the city. Hopefully he's still around and doing well. So shout out Cincinnati.
Somebody just told me the Isley Brothers is from here. Man, I didn't even know that.
Yeah,
that's crazy. Yeah, Cincinnati is rich though, you know, with talent and with good people. You know, I stayed here about a year and a half, you know, in my heyday, and I fell in love with the town, man. They had to run me out. The feds ran me out, man. I didn't want to go. Hey, Dave, I didn't want to go. The feds told me. They said, you can't stay here.
Well, it must be good to be back in your old stomping grounds, visiting and putting in that good work out there for the people.
Yeah, we're doing a fundraiser today and tomorrow for orphans, you know, kids that's in foster homes and just different places, you know, because when those kids get out sometimes, they don't have any backing, you know. A lot of times they're in foster homes because their mom or dad went to jail, got on drugs, or maybe got killed, or, you know, whatever thing happened, molested in the home. And then when they get out at 18 years old, you know, they don't have anywhere to go. So shout out to Xavier for raising money for those kids.
Definitely. So we're going to jump right in. You know, we went back and we started watching the first season of Snowfall. So that's season one. And we just watched episode two, which is called Make Them Birds Fly. And like I said, I can remember when this first came out a number of years back and being, you know, anticipating watching it. And it kept me going. I mean, the second episode was solid. A lot of interesting things are taking place and the story's developing. But, you know, I know it's a little different for you. But how'd you feel watching the episode?
Well, you know what? It's more realistic. You know, I can say that much for it. There was some parts that I had some disagreements with. I don't think that they really gave the audience a chance to really see the character grow into the business. You know, it's very seldom that somebody walks into the game and they get a kilo of cocaine. Especially at $12,000 a kilo, right. You know, my first kilo I bought, day was like $45,000. You know, so I had to work my way up from a gram of cocaine. So when I see somebody just walk in and the first time they meet the guy, you know, he gives him a key of cocaine. I was like, wow, lucky guy. You know, how fortunate was he?
they definitely sped the process up to get Franklin up and running and in the mix with the Mexicans and, you know, the CIA and the Israeli gangster and so on. They definitely sped that up. So, you know, that's all good. You know, it just leaves more material for you, you know, to cover when your movie comes out, to get into more of the, you know, background and what you really went through and getting things going and how you got there and your own series, which I know you're working on both of those. So
absolutely. You know. Absolutely. And I'm ecstatic to be able, because I think that's so important to really get the gist of what it takes. And I think that's what people want. People want to know how are these people created? You know, how do they come about? You know, do they just fall out of the sky? And pretty much the way they're showing it here is that, you know, he really just fell out of the sky. You know, he ran into Ivy and, you know, Ivy put him down, per se. But I never wanted to be put down. You know, when somebody puts you down, they can always take it away from you. So I believe that it's always better when you earn your keep on your own.
Yeah, I hear you. So, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of interesting characters that we're learning more about as the second episode unfolds. You know, we're seeing some really significant themes that the show is kind of able to tie together in a you know way that, you know, generally makes sense and is certainly interesting. And that's, you know, everything from, you know, family, money, the CIA, you know, the Mexicans, race is in the mix already here, you know, between the black folks, the Latinos and the white people as well. We're seeing all elements of the racial dynamics coming out in this second episode as well. So, you know, it's a lot of compelling stuff. I mean, we're getting to know Teddy a little bit better. The new CIA guy who's taken over for the hard partying, Logan that OD'd last week.
Yeah. Yeah. And Teddy's character, you're getting to see, basically how he got to where he was when we started the show. So we're definitely getting some understanding from that. And at this time, Teddy seems like he's pretty straightforward, you know, at this time, not cutting the corners that he does later on in the episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Teddy to me, you know, they first show him, you know, as kind of just this sort of quiet, you know, unassuming, you know, kind of guy behind the desk, but he seems like he's quickly coming into his own in his new role here, starting to take charge. And like you said, no nonsense, you know, we're going to close this house down and find a new, you know, stash spot immediately. You know, of course, he's getting into it with Alejandro over the earring that he found on the scene. And, you know, so he's really trying to, you know, cover all the bases, but, you know, also,
and the blonde hair, he found the blonde hair too. Remember?
That's right. That's right.
So he's figuring that more went on than what Alejandro had talked to him about. And, you know, he asks Alejandro to be straight up with him. And, he knows that he's lying to him. I believe that he knows that he's lying to him. Right. You know, remember he also said he found blood all over the house. So it was more than just one place so that he found blood.
Yeah, so that's that no nonsense attitude, like, you know, we're gonna, you know, get to the bottom of this. We gotta be, you know, 100% with each other. But we also start to see him, you know, I think in the scene where he goes back to see Avi the second time, because, you know, they showed up at Avi's the first time, you know, there was a lot of drama with Avi pulling the gun on him and accusing him of wearing a wire and everybody's undressing. You know, that was a pretty interesting scene. And by the time he comes back to see Avi later on in the episode, you know, he's like playing kind of hardball with Avi and says, look, man, you know, I'm just here to tell you we're not doing business no more. He calls Avi's bluff and has Avi apologizing to him and, you know, kind of laying down the rules and even asking to have a drink together. So we're seeing Teddy, you know, quickly go from this unassuming, quiet guy to, you know, this new head of, you know, CIA drug international drug operations.
And you know what else too? Now, apparently, now I don't know if I'm wrong or not, but Teddy and them just missed Franklin at the house. Remember, because the guy was sick.
That's right.
And that's what caused all the disturbance when Teddy and them had to leave. Yep. And then shortly after that, Franklin comes and takes the same guy to the hospital. That is the same guy, right?
It is. Yeah. They did just miss each other. Franklin shows up shortly after Teddy and Alejandro leave.
Now that could have really been a coincidence, you know, with them bumping heads that early in the scene.
Yeah, well, they look like they're, you know, heading to start to get to know each other. And, you know, these are all the kind of main characters we're starting to get a feel for. I wanted to talk about Avi since we're mentioning him. I mean, he's such a, you know, a crazy guy. We talked a little bit about him last week and how wild he was in that first episode. And we see, you know, we've seen more of it, but he's still, you know, seems to sort of have like a little bit of a fatherly instinct with Franklin and trying to bring some wisdom, you know, amidst his craziness. You know, did you ever run into anybody that resembles Avi in your travels, you know?
Nah, I wouldn't have put up with Avi. No, I wouldn't have put up with nobody pointing no gun at me, talking about put on no vest, telling me I got to strip and get naked. You know, those were out. You know, when you come with the cash, you don't have to take no bullshit. So, you know, I usually came with my cash and let my cash talk. But I haven't ran anybody. No. You know, drinking and all that partying in the game, the way I was in it, was definitely a liability. You know, you definitely didn't want to be in those positions. And that's one of the reasons that I don't drink today is because, you know, I always thought, you know, you wake up drunk in somebody's trunk, was definitely not where I wanted to be. And, you know, but Avi got an army around him. So I guess he can pretty much do what he want to do.
A couple more people I think we should talk about. You know, Oso is starting to become an interesting guy, you know, going from, you know, this street fighter, wrestler character and, you know, now working his way into this Mexican cartel with Lucia and Pedro, that are first cousins. You know, their fathers are brothers and they're apparently the heads of this pretty large Mexican cartel. And but also is interesting, you know, as somebody that's kind of going to bring, that's, I don't know if you call it a voice of reason or sort of a sense of standards and morals. You know, he's really upset when he finds out the job that they sent him to do was to steal money from, you know, Pedro's dad and Lucia's uncle. And of course, you know, he gets surprised there by one of the dad's, you know, guys and ends up having to kill him. And he's not happy about that. And you know, you see that kind of like, oh, you know, you would betray your own family for money. And he's really concerned about that.
Yeah, he was. I admired that about him as well, because I think it's pretty low when you start stealing from your loved ones, you know. Stealing is one thing, but then when you start stealing from your dad and your mom and your uncles, you know, that's something else. But also it's kind of falling for Lucio already. You know, he sees this little pretty girl and I think he's already started to fall for her and pretty much anything that she's doing, he's going to be there to protect her. I think he looks at himself as her protector, almost somebody who's supposed to watch over her. And that was interesting. But yeah, I like Oso's morals and his loyalty too. You know, his loyalty is pretty strong.
Yeah, even like when he in the scene where Teddy they're over Teddy's, I guess, house, him and Lucia show up and, you know, they meet Teddy for the first time. You know, he's a little standoffish. Of course, Teddy's acting a little bit, you know, strange and trying to be funny or whatever it is. And but at the end, you know, he shakes his hand, also looks at it, thinks about it, said, okay, you know, we're going to be doing business together. You know, I'm at least going to shake your hand. That's the type of guy he is. You know, we're seeing that already.
Yeah, you have to wear him down. You know, you have to prove your loyalty to him and your sincerity before he's going to cut into you.
Yeah.
Which I like that about. I like that about him.
So we learn, you know, that the reason that the kids here, these cousins, are going to the lengths of robbing their own dad is because they desperately want to get into the cocaine business. And, you know, I guess they've been dealing weed. And now they have an opportunity, apparently, to get into the coke business. They need some cash to make the buy. And this was their plan to, you know, steal the money from their dad and put it back before he knew it was missing. But, you know, they're definitely very desperate to get into the cocaine business, which is interesting, again, just to, you know, look at the evolution of the drug business in the 80s and at what point, you know, cocaine starts to become in more demand.
Well, you know what else really surprised me when they did the numbers, you know, on the cocaine, they were adding up the numbers. And I thought those numbers were pretty significant. At one time they said a kilo is going for $12,000, and then they said that they're going to make off of 25 kilos, $2.5 million. I'm like, what kind of numbers y'all using? the numbers are all over the place, you know? And that's a lot of times, you know, that's how the police do with the numbers. They just throw numbers out. They don't really sit down and add up, you know, what's really going on. Because you see, when Franklin is getting the kilos, I think he's getting them for $12,000 from Ivy, and I think he's selling them to the girl for $16,000. So that's only, you know, $16,000 a kilo. So if you got 25 kilos, 16 a piece, you know, I mean, it's a nice money, but it is nowhere near $2.5 million.
Right. Well, but I wanted to ask you about this because when they go to their, you know, their secret location, go through some type of club thing, and then they go through the back, of course, and there's their, you know, the Mexican ladies are waiting who are going to be, you know, I guess, bagging up the cocaine. You know, they make them strip down. But when she's introducing also to that whole thing, she's breaking it down, you know, all the different levels and steps. But, you know, they're not just selling large amounts. They're actually breaking this down and selling it in smaller, you know,
in grams.
Amounts. Yeah, grams. He was talking about $100 a gram. But, yeah, I wanted to see what you thought of that whole scene of like a coke house set up like that, and some of the other things he mentioned about what they would do. You know, they got to pay this person, the dealer gets 10%, we got to pay off these people. She kind of really went into detail.
It was a lot. She was saying a lot. You know, I wasn't able to write everything down, but I caught a few things that she said. She was saying that a gram was going for $100, and then they took in so many losses, you know, they could count on losing 10 bags bursting, or, you know, just different scenarios I don't know how she was able to predict those things, but, you know, at the end of the day, she was. But it's really tough if kilos are selling on the street for $16,000 a kilo. It would take me a few minutes to do the math, but I can imagine that's probably around $16 a gram. Roughly. So if one person is selling grams for $16 a gram, and then another one is selling them for $100 a gram, it's pretty far-fetched. You know, usually the prices are pretty level around the city. You know, when you're dropping them off, it kind of levels off the prices of what it goes for. So to say that they're getting $100 a gram, it's kind of far-fetched when kilos are selling for $16,000.
Yeah. So I know your main supplier ended up being a Nicaraguan. And of course, we have him represented in the show here with Alejandro. But what was the, you know, place of the Mexicans at that time in terms of, you know, this game? Were the Mexican cartels, you know, that prevalent, you know, on your scene and in the cocaine business, or did that come later?
The Mexican cartel came later. first, it was the Colombian and the blacks, you know, working together. The blacks started to rob the Colombians, you know, started to take their cocaine. And that's when they went to the Mexican cartel. First, you know, blacks controlled the market at first.
So the Colombians brought it to Mexicans.
Right. Where the Colombians started, you know, once that they found out that the black market wasn't going to make it anymore, you know, because what happened is once the cops came in and scooped up all the black drug dealers, you know, they I guess probably like 87, 86, they started like wiping out everybody, you know, all the guys with the names. So once they wiped those guys out, then the Colombian cartels started dealing with other guys who were not hustlers. You know, that's probably where, you know, where they went to a guy like Franklin who had never sold drugs before and gave him a kilo of cocaine. Well, you know, quite naturally what the gangbanger's going to do, they're going to take it from him. They're not going to pay for it.
Right. Right.
And so after that started happening so many times, you know, the Colombians kind of wised up and say, you know what, we're going to start giving this to the Mexicans.
And then the Mexicans would be the intermediaries to any of the black dealers.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, well, it's interesting to learn. I mean, there was a few other things that stood out. You know, there's a scene where Franklin goes with his mom to help evict this woman out of these, you know, rundown projects or tenements, you know, that the white man.
Slumlords. That's what we call them.
Yeah. Sissy's smart. And she goes in and has Franklin open up the vent and discovers the chicken milk bomb. I didn't know anything about that. You ever heard of a chicken milk bomb?
Never heard of it. Never heard of it.
That sound, I mean, it must be, I'm thinking it must be a real thing. She said that I guess they leave the chicken and the milk in a jar in the vent hidden. And then at some point it expands, it explodes and destroys the apartment, so it's a way for you to, you know, kind of sabotage the landlord. But
I never heard of that before though. That was the first for me.
We gotta do some research on the chicken milk bomb. Find out where did that come from, huh?
Sound like some witch doctor stuff to me, you know. Maybe some Louisiana.
Okay. It could be
witchcraft or something, you know, where they put it together.
Could be. So let's talk about Frank.
And look like Franklin mom is messing with the slumlord, you know, the way he's putting his hands on her. I don't know if you saw that or not, but Franklin caught that the way he was putting his hand on her waist, and Franklin didn't really care for it. Right before they threw the milk bomb.
No, I didn't. But remember last week we talked about how her sweater was ripped when she got home. So that could be all the same thing. He might be getting a little rough with her. And, you know.
Maybe she's doing some extras. She's doing some extras other than collecting rent. Right.
Well, I think all of this serves as motivation for Franklin. Franklin's like, he don't want to see his mom going through this. He don't want to see her having to deal with this type of person, the slumlord. He just, you know, he really wants to be able to do more. And we see, you know, after this little taste he gets, he's hooked. You know, he's hooked on making money. You know, he's ready to get back and re-up. And we also see him starting to have some fun. He does go out, you know, on a spur of the moment and just buy the motorcycle on the street off the guy. And he's off riding. Did you ever ride motorcycles? I can't remember if I've asked you that before.
Yeah, I had motorcycles. Yeah, I had a motorcycle that I bought from some guys, Vance and Hines. I don't know if you know who they are, but they was the fastest guys, motorcycle guys in the world. So I bought a motorcycle off of them one time that had just set a world record, matter of fact. And I had a couple street bikes too, but I didn't ride much. You know, it was just ride for 15, 20 minutes and go put it up. I was always a little leery of motorcycles for that vulnerability of not being safe.
Right. But you know, generally you like to have fun and do some kind of thrill seeking things. You talked about your boats and you know, speed boat and everything.
Dirt bikes. I had dirt bikes. You know, I was more with the dirt bikes than street bikes, but I had street bikes too. You know, I had a Z1R Kawasaki. Okay. You know, we used to fix them up like low riders, put the fancy paint jobs on them and the wheels. But I hardly rode it, you know, it was just once in a while, just a show thing, you know, when I want to go show off on a Sunday or something like that, you know, you might pull it out and ride down the street and let everybody wave at you, you know, but not a regular motorcycle rider. He looked more like he was using his motorcycle as his transportation, you know, and then, I couldn't use a motorcycle as transportation. It was, to me, too dangerous.
All right. Any other thrill-seeking memories you have?
You know, I had the drag car. You know, I had a pro comp car. Was going to jump into the pro stocker was my goal. I thought about one day being a race car driver, you know, becoming a professional race car driver. So I did that as well. I had a few thrills, you know, when you start having that money, you start to look for ways to broaden your horizon, you know, do some things that you never thought you'd be able to do before.
Yeah. Well, how about these days, Rick? You still, you know, get excited about, you know, thrilling experiences, doing anything along those lines these days?
Not really. You know, when you get older, you know, you slow down a little bit. You don't want to take those falls. You know, when you're younger, you can take those falls on those motorcycles and recover. But when you get old, you recover real slow. So now I think my thrills are creating businesses and winning.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess I want to wrap up on Franklin a little bit more. You know, he's also starting to quickly come into his own. Like I said, he's hooked right away on the money and, you know, having the fun, but he's also dealing with problems. He's also continuing to show he can be calm under pressure. You know, he has no problem jumping in Avi's Rolls Royce with a half dead guy in the back seat, you know, just dropping him off at the hospital to help Avi out. You know, we get a little glimpse of the love interest side of Franklin, with Melody continuing, his next door neighbor who he bumps into, outside one evening while he's walking home with his bag of kilos.
Yeah, that was another one, just walking around with kilos. I mean, cuffing the bag, you know, like, damn, put that shit up. You know what I'm saying? When I got my first gram, Dave, I was nervous as hell. You know, I thought the FBI was watching me, the CIA, everybody. You know, it's like, you know, I don't know. It would be hard for me, you know, first starting out to have a kilo of cocaine. I probably would have drove myself, you know, crazy. I'd been peeping out the windows and everything else, having that much cocaine all at one time.
Right. Well, so the very end of the episode, Franklin, he's all excited, got his motorcycle. He took care of business for Avi. He's got, I guess, two more keys on hand. He's back to go see Claudia at the nightclub. And, you know, he thinks everything's cool. They go inside. They sit down. She tries to short him a couple grand and see if he wants to, you know, explore any of the things she got going on in her nightclub after hours. But he says, nah, I'm just, you know, just give me my money, give me the whole 32 grand. So he gets his money, and then he goes out to take off in the back, and of course, you know, he's set up by these two, you know, two guys that pull up on him, beat the crap out of him, steal his money. So we know he's not going to be happy about that.
That's a lesson. Get that money and run. Don't be hanging around, waiting around, looking. Yeah, because I thought he had time to make a move, you know, and get out of there when he saw those guys. And I think he waited too late, you know, to make his move. But that's another lesson that he just learned. You know, you got to watch out for the Jackets now, too.
Right. Right. I mean, it looks like the lady of Claudia probably set him up, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. She put him up on him. But, you know, he got to be alert. You know, when you're talking about walking around the neighborhood, when you're the only one with, you know, with money, you know, you got $32,000 and everybody else is, you know, is pitching pennies. It's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how Franklin responds to this and what he's prepared to do to try to get his money, because he's got to get that money to Avi now. He doesn't want to let Avi down. So we'll see what happens next week.
You don't want to owe Avi.
No, he don't. Avi already knows where he lives and everything. So
Avi's a loose cannon.
So there's great music in the show again this week, which is another staple of the production. You know, really great music. Even the background sound effects, I noticed when you're watching, you're hearing things in the background, the environment and everything are really, really well done. But yeah, they end with Franklin getting the shit beat out of him while Lovely Day, Bill Withers, is playing in the background. So you know, just when you think everything's, you know, looking up, you're catching this beat down and losing all your money.
Yeah, that's tragic.
Yeah, yeah. But good music throughout. So, you know, shout out to the Snowfall team on the music selection. John Singleton, the creator of Snowfall, was obviously hands-on in this early stages. You know, rest in peace to John. So yeah, this is After the Snow. We're going to keep going with season one. We'll be back again next week talking about the third episode. We hope that you guys will keep on with the ride. We're working on some more guests that we'll be announcing soon to have back on the show. So yeah, this is After the Snow. We're part of Breakbeat Media, home to Don't Call Me White Girl, home to the new Funny Marco podcast coming soon. Home to the Unsigned Hype story that's coming, the documentary podcast coming soon, home to Trapping Anonymous, a few more things I might be forgetting, but Breakbeat making its mark out here. We're happy to, you know, bring this content to you guys.
Yep. Yeah, well, can't wait till next week, man. We get to this next episode and see what happens after the beatdown. See how he's going to recover this money. This is going to be interesting. You know, I think it's kind of hard to recover $32,000 in the hood, you know. Right. And I know whoever took it don't want to give it back. One thing about robbers, when they take it, they don't plan on giving it back. So this is going to be interesting to see.
All right, well, stay tuned, y'all. We'll see y'all next week After the Snow. We out.
Peace.
Peace.